Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Let me be clear. The indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, the killing of women and children and innocent bystanders by chemical weapons is a moral obscenity.
John Kerry first became famous in the 1970s for the question, how do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? You know that history of John Kerry? Let's hope no one will have to ask him the same question about U.S. involvement in Syria. After Kerry's statement yesterday and his stentorian, no uncertain terms voice, there is little doubt that the U.S. military is about to get involved with hundreds apparently dead in a chemical weapons attack in Syria. Let's hope this is not a mistake.
The meaning of this attack goes beyond the conflict in Syria itself. And that conflict has already brought so much terrible suffering. This is about the large-scale, indiscriminate use of weapons that the civilized world long ago decided must never be used at all, a conviction shared even by countries that agree on little else. There is a clear reason that the world has banned entirely the use of chemical weapons. There is a reason the international community has set a clear standard and why many countries have taken major steps to eradicate these weapons.
Another 45 seconds of Secretary of State Kerry yesterday. Our first guest today is Aaron David Miller, a former U.S. Middle East advisor and negotiator, now vice president of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He has an opinion piece on Politico today, simply titled, "The U.S. Will Bomb Syria." Mr. Miller, thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Pleasure to be here.
So, yes, the U.S. will bomb Syria. It sure looks that way. But do you agree that first the U.S. has to build the biggest coalition possible of countries saying an attack is being done in their name, too?
I think that'll help create a context of legitimacy, since you're not going to get a U.N. Security Council resolution because the Russians and the Chinese will block action. And there's precedent for this.
Right.
In Kosovo. I think the broader coalition will help. I think the countries are only too willing, it seems to me, to pledge their support. I don't think it's the before action issue that's the problem here. For the United States, and this will not be a Libyan enterprise, we will obviously take the lead, given the sensitivity and complexity of what is required to operate militarily in Syria. The problem for the administration is that addressing this specific aspect of the chemical weapons issue, and remember, there are over 60 sites in Syria. The regime has tons of this stuff. So the issue is how to punish Assad for what he's done, presumably how to deter him from doing it again, but none of it will address the broader issue. The dispersal of these weapons, the possibility over time he can use them again, and, of course, the broader issue of what to do about a country that is hemorrhaging refugees, exporting sectarian tension and violence, creating opportunities for all kinds of extremists, both on the Sunni al-Qaeda and the Shia spectrum. So whatever the president does, and I believe he does have to do something, it's not going to answer the mail with regard to the broader crisis that is now Syria.
And I think that contradiction, that paradox that you just laid out, is exemplified in this clip of Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee on Fox News Sunday, who makes it sound like we have to do something to stop Assad from using these chemical weapons, but he also makes it sound like instead of sending in missiles, we'd be sending in doctors.
I think we will respond in a surgical way, and I hope the president, as soon as we get back to Washington, will ask for authorization from Congress to do something in a very surgical and proportional way, something that gets their attention, that causes them to understand that we are not going to put up with this kind of activity.
So he says surgical twice, but he says something that gets their attention, that causes them to understand that we are not going to put up with this kind of activity. Those two really contradict each other, don't they?
Well, again, this has to be seen along a continuum. The question of any military action, and the president understands the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan, military power is an instrument. It's a means to effect, presumably, a political end. And Iraq and Afghanistan are the two longest wars in American history where the standard for victory was never could we win, but when could we leave. And the lesson, the appropriate lesson that this president has drawn from those two wars, is that there has to be a correlation between your military power and what it's designed to achieve. So the real question, Brian, is what is a strike against Syria designed to achieve? There are any number of targets that could be identified that would raise the costs and demonstrate that we're serious. We could attack command and control structure. You can go after the units associated with this attack. You could attack military infrastructure, and you can do much, much more. But again, the question is here, and it's not a rhetorical question. I wish I had the answer.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that the president hopes to achieve? Is he going to try to tip the battlefield balance and create a new one so that the opposition is strengthened and can over time defeat Assad? That would require a sustained and comprehensive military strategy on the part of the United States. Or is this a kind of a one-off, which is designed, as I mentioned earlier, to address the narrow issue of chemical weapons? The problem here is what happens the day after, and it is a cautionary tale to great powers who want to intervene in the affairs of small tribes. The small tribes, they may be small, but they're meaner, they're more determined with respect to their own survival, and they are prepared, as Assad's use of chemical weapons demonstrates, to go way beyond what we're prepared to do on the cruelty and barbarity scale.
Listeners, Aaron David Miller, Vice President at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a former U.S. Mideast negotiator and advisor. Do you want to join the conversation about whether to go militarily into Syria? Is it still a whether for you, even after what we're learning about that chemical weapons attack last week? Or want to talk about how? 212-433-WNYC. You hear the question that our guest is framing about what the goal should be. 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show or tweet at Brian Lehrer. And Mr. Miller, should I assume, though I think the range of options you just laid out goes beyond this, but should I assume that the U.S. and whatever coalition is going to be unwilling to take the risk of ground troops or even of flying air missions over Syria? I think they're talking about launching cruise missiles from the sea and concerned that Syria has enough air defense missiles or air defense, of whatever kind, ground-to-air missiles, whatever they have, that it would put American or other pilots at risk to fly sorties over Syria.
I think there's no question about that. But, you know, we have the capacity, assuming we're prepared to shoulder or to court the risks, of suppressing Syrian air defenses, which would be a prelude to a much more comprehensive, sustained military strategy. But I don't think that's what the president has in mind. The problem is, where does this end? I mean, if Assad calls Obama's bluff and deploys chemical weapons again, and the president launches another series of attacks, this time more punishing and more comprehensive. But in the end, what in the end will air power essentially do? Now, there are many who argue that it will, in fact, level the playing field. It will allow the opposition, as inchoate and as divided as it is. And let's be clear here. You know, we're not talking about an opposition that is schooled in democratic process and respect for human rights. I mean, I've been reading some of the stories about this unfortunate American photographer who happened to spend 7 months in an al-Qaeda-related prison.
Yeah.
And these are the best-trained forces, the most committed, the most religiously driven. So, you know, we're not talking here about you're talking about 1,000 groups of disparate militias and various sizes and characters and patrons and ideologies. This isn't even Libya.
So what's the goal? Is it of an attack? Is it just to set a global humanitarian standard that weapons of mass destruction used against mass populations are illegitimate and will be responded to?
That seemed to be the view of the Secretary of State
That's pretty high-minded.
It is, and I, this is the tendency in all democracies, but particularly in this one, to lay the basis for military action using the highest-minded objectives. The problem, however, is that the higher-minded your objective, the more idealized your conception of why you're acting, the bigger the gap between what you're saying and what you can actually, you know, deliver. It's the old saw, Brian, you know, politics is about what people want, governance is about what they get.
Right.
The fact is that gap, we need to be respectful and mindful of that gap. And I come back to Iraq and Afghanistan, not because the parallel here is boots on the ground. It's a false analogy. 60% of the American public right now and a good portion of its elected representatives in Congress have no intention of supporting an open-ended military strategy that leads to that. The question is the relationship between the application of American military power and the end game. It was true in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's true with regard to any potential military strike on putative Iranian nuclear facilities.
Right.
That's the problem.
And I come back to Libya, which began as a simple no-fly zone to protect civilians from Gaddafi warplanes, but the imperative for NATO to up the ante to regime change was irresistible. So if Assad continues to kill thousands, calls Obama's bluff, as you say, mostly with conventional weapons even, why won't the same thing happen in this case?
I think if by same thing you mean making
regime change end game.
It will happen. And remember, it took 8 months to get rid of Gaddafi when you had a relatively coate and unified opposition, a country of 6 million people, roughly the size of the state of Alaska, that had tremendous oil wealth to rebuild. Here, you have a country that is already riven with sectarian and political differences. I mean, 100,000 people have been killed. The amount of score-settling vendettas and revenge that is going to have to work itself out would require thousands of monitors and peacekeepers. The whole situation is untenable. This president, one of only 17 to be reelected to a second term, his own legacy he fashions in terms of the middle class, not the Middle East. He has no intention, and he has willfully avoided it. No intention of taking the United States down this road and getting stuck with the check on Syria.
Aaron David Miller from the Woodrow Wilson International Center on WNYC. And Ayub in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Brian. Great show. I have two quick questions. The first one is related to the United States-Russian, relation, because Sergei Lavrov now is accusing the United States of going beyond what the international law is allowing them to do. And this, then what this relation will become, we have in mind the Snowden problem and now what will happen next.
And the gay athletes. But what's the next one?
The next one is because I'm a Muslim and I fear that the Muslim reaction, having in mind also the involvement of the United States in Halabja, everybody thinks that the United States has something to do with that chemical, when Saddam did use that chemical weapon against his own people. So how trustworthy are the United States in this? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Two great questions. Aaron David Miller, you want to take them?
Well, I think in the issue of U.S.-Russian relations, it's going to continue to get worse for many different reasons. The Russians are in an investment trap in Syria. They've seen Americans dispatch some of their clients, Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein. Putin is absolutely determined, and he's created a box for himself. He now is in a position where he has to rationalize away what appears to be the massive deployment of chemical weapons. And by the way, this is could be the largest deployment since Ayub's reference to Halabja, where Saddam Hussein used gas against thousands of Iraqi Kurds, and killing at least 5,000. I, as far as conspiracy theories are concerned with respect to the Iraqis, I mean, there is on the foreignpolicy.com website an interesting piece about American awareness of Iraq's willingness to use chemicals against Kurds, and it occurred during a period where we were determined to support Saddam because we feared his enemy worse, which was which was Iran.
And we're so morally compromised in the Middle East because of so much more than that. Our interest in oil and the Cold War and desire to be in charge, from the more recent Iraq War to backing Saddam earlier, whether or not we were complicit in that particular attack, to backing Mubarak's authoritarian government, to overthrowing Mossadegh in Iran. How far should I go here?
Well, you're doing pretty well. The fact is, the anomalies and contradictions in American policy are abound. You know, we support an Arab Spring in Egypt, but not in Saudi Arabia. We intervene in Libya, but not in Syria. I mean, there may be justifications for each of these things, but it appears to be contradictory, directionless. And the sources of anger against America in this region run deep. It's not just the perception that we somehow support everything that the Israelis do. It's our support for authoritarian kings. It's Iraq and Afghanistan. It's everything we aren't responsible for that we are blamed for anyway.
Yeah.
So I think my view of this region is very simple. It's not terribly uplifting. It's broken, angry, and dysfunctional, and it's going to remain that way for a long time. And sadly, we are stuck in the middle of a region we cannot fix and we cannot leave. And therein lies the greatest challenge, not just for President Obama, because this is going to be around long after he leaves the White House. This is the problem for the United States, still the greatest and most consequential power on earth. It is a terrible predicament for such a power to be in.
Tom in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hello, Tom.
Hi, thanks. I want to say I'm not a pacifist. I fought in Fallujah in 2004. I think the question needs to be less about going in there, as we know almost no Americans support that. And more about the question of how two countries, Saudi Arabia and Israel, could have gotten so much control over our foreign policy when neither of those countries has sent troops in any of our wars. And we know that the Saudis fund Salafi preachers around the world. And as for the Israelis, they're only slightly better. They spy on us. And Google up Ovadia Yosef, the Shas party spiritual leader, to get a different take on how little they value the lives of Americans. So that's what we need to talk about, how these two countries who benefit the most from knocking out Iran's most major military ally, how they got control over our foreign policy.
Tom, thank you. Well, without going down the rabbit hole of, Israel and Saudi domestic politics and what's true or not true, he's right about the geopolitics, isn't he? The basic fact that both Saudi Arabia and Israel want the U.S. to do this because Syria is the closest ally of Iran?
Well, I think, first of all, let's be clear about something. These are two countries, and the caller is quite right. These are two countries in which we have special relationships. They both emerged in the 40s for very different reasons. One was driven by oil and our perception of Saudi Arabia as a modernizing monarchy. The other, the only democratic polity in the region, despite any of its imperfections and excesses with respect to the West Bank and Gaza. These two countries, the United States has invested in heavily for different reasons for the last 60 years. And it's not because, quote unquote, they have control over our policies. We're not some kind of potted plant. The United States has interests, it has relationships with both of these countries for very different reasons. Are there tensions and anomalies and divergence of interests? Absolutely. But we are not controlled by these policies. In the case of the Israelis, the pro-Israeli community in this country, which includes, millions of evangelical Christians, a small but extremely influential Jewish community of 5.5 million, and millions of Americans. Read the Gallup polls. The one in March of this year is extraordinary. It shows support among Americans for Israel at an all-time high. And that's largely because of perception of value affinity. So the reality is, on the narrower question, sure, countries' interests diverge. Do I believe that the Israelis and the Saudis would love the United States to take care of their respective Iranian problem, which links Israel and Saudi Arabia in a sort of perverse way? Absolutely. Do I believe that we are like some robot going to march to the tune of both of these countries? Absolutely not. In fact, this president has gone to extreme lengths, and I believe will continue to go to extreme lengths, just as he stayed out of Syria, to avoid a unilateral American military strike against Iran or to greenlight an Israeli one. At the end of the day, who knows what ultimately is going to happen? But I judge the odds of military action by the U.S. against Iran right now to be extremely low.
So last question, and to that point, and I wish we could go on with this. In a way, I feel like we're just getting started. But why can't another country take this military action with its warplanes and its missiles? If we're just talking about a few cruise missiles or the equivalent, this international punishment for a moral obscenity doesn't need the unique size of the United States military. Maybe let Arab League members do it, or Saudi Arabia, which we sell warplanes to and has this interest that you and the caller agree is there, or Israel similarly, which has a more direct stake than the United States, or France, which seems very hawkish on this and is much closer to the region. Why is this our fight when it's more any of their fight?
It's a very good question, and it's a question I ask all the time. I think the Europeans are reluctant to lead. They would like to push us into a position where we would essentially take charge of an international effort on Syria. We do sell the UAE, the Saudis, sophisticated aircraft, and the Egyptians, of course, but look at the anomalies that abound now in that relationship. The fact is we have a degree of competence, a degree of skill in order to discharge this particular military action. And given the vulnerabilities of the president with respect to that terrible formulation, whoever coined it, leading from behind, there's no way that we on this one aren't going to be up front. I am just extremely worried about where this one is going to go, given the limitations of our capacity to fix and address the real problem. Remember, last point, military power is a means to achieve an end. It's a tool and an instrument. And you know what they say, Brian, if you don't know where you're going, just about any road will get you there.
There you go. With Aaron David Miller, Vice President at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a former U.S. Mideast negotiator and advisor. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this conversation.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, President Obama's plan for raiding colleges and universities. Good idea that will save many families a lot of money and improve education, or a no college student left behind debacle that'll turn universities into standardized test mills like K through 12. We'll talk about it with a guest from the Chronicle of Higher Education. Stay with us.